continue. Just wanting to check in. Is there anything left over from this morning in terms of questions or any areas of unclarity that we'd like to clarify? Yes, please. Well, we don't need to have strategies for wholesome shame. Wholesome shame is something that just comes pretty intuitively and pretty immediately. What do we do with it? What do we do with it? It's telling us something, you know? It's telling us something that somehow we just got off track somewhere, you know, in our speech or in our actions, although also in our thoughts, if we're actually fairly sensitive to that. You know, there's not something we... Well, is there something we need to do with it? Well, possibly. You know, often when the Buddha speaks about freedom, he speaks about it as a freedom from indebtedness. You know, and he used the analogy of financial debt, you know, that when we're owing a lot of money, you know, the amount of anxiety and story and fear and apprehension and busyness that is implicated in that. But he was speaking much more about emotional and psychological debt. And if we want to know what we're indebted to inwardly, we just need to see what we ruminate about the most. This is actually what we're not at peace with. And some of that might be to do with wholesome shame, you know, that actually we keep revisiting territories of regret, you know. So the Buddha actually, you know, really encouraged acts of peacemaking, you know, and sometimes this is external, you know, I apologize to somebody, or I'm upfront about, you know, I just really lost my way in this, you know. Sometimes that's not possible because it's already gone by and, you know, situations have changed. In which case, you know, all that we do is undertake peacemaking with that narrative of regret, you know, that actually the acknowledgement there's no more that can be done, but actually what can be done is just resetting our ethical compass and making a commitment to that. There's actually no more that can be done. The rest of it is just story. The rest of it is just story where it's turning wholesome shame probably into something much bigger, you know, like self-judgment or self-view or, you know, self-castigation. So it takes wholesome shame and turns it into a kind of view of self. Yes, please. Yep, in the Buddha's words, yeah.
I can't extract a lot of wisdom that was years. Do you have any suggestions for supplemental reading to help me when I'm reading
the discourses? Yeah, I think there is a great art to reading the discourses, you know, and I really encourage people to go to the early texts because a lot of people read only contemporary literature and there's a lot of that and I'm a contributor to it and all the rest of it, you know. I think there's a huge value in going to the early texts, but I really recommend reading together with others, you know, because often, there is a study group here in Seattle, you know, but to actually form a group that actually, or go to a program that's actually around study, because this is so much better done, you know. I have to confess, you know, in my early days of trying to read the suttas, these were a great antidote for sleepless nights. Far more effective than a sleeping pill, you know. It's a bit of a copy of the discourse, and then I'd be out. Those days are gone. Now I'm very invigorated. It would have the opposite effect on me. But I think this is line-by-line reading. This is line-by-line reading, you know, because sometimes it's in just a few words that actually the whole treasure of that discourse is held. You know, I was recently teaching from a sutta, The Wilderness of the Heart. Actually, I was just teaching that. No, sorry, the Honeyball Sutta. I was just teaching that in Victoria last weekend. And there's one line in there, you know, where it says, when no more here is found to delight in, welcome, or cling to, this fades away. And like that says everything. You know, when there's no more found here to delight in, welcome, or cling to, the whole fabrication process falls away. Well, you know, that's kind of like it, in that short line. You know, but it's so easy to sort of gloss over that line and think, oh, well, that's not really very significant, actually. You know, so you need to find ways. You know, this is much better read aloud. You know, remember, it's an oral tradition. That stuff is much better read aloud. And then you need to reflect on it. But it's really line-by-line reading. But better in the company of others. Also, if you want some, I have to, this is not self-promotion, by the way, I'm not promoting a new venture, but the Bodhi College website has one of the best reading lists around. Bodhi College, B-O-D-H-I, college.org. It has one of the best reading lists around. Is there anything else lingering from this morning? We're all perfectly clear and up to date. If you're not, do say so. What we ended up talking about this morning, at the end of the morning, was actually the conditions that incline the mind towards awakening. You know, we talked about, you know, listening to the Dharma, you know, practicing, about associating with the wise. You know, this is a very crucial piece, and the whole piece that I haven't mentioned in those conditions that incline the mind towards awakening are the conditions of meditative development. You know, this was not all taking place in a vacuum. This was all taking place, being taught and being practiced in the context of dedicated practice and practitioners. If you look at the early texts, it becomes quite evident that the Buddha was not very prescriptive in terms of how to practice. In fact, probably the only two places of development that he actually really offered almost a kind of pathway of development or a technique were in the areas of samatha practice and in the areas of metta practice. You know, these are the two sole areas where the Buddha seemed to get down to the nuts and bolts of actually what you might do when you sit on a cushion. You know? Now, it seems from reading the early texts that the Buddha actually considered that these two areas were quite sufficient. You know, if you actually cultivated these two domains well, that you actually had everything in place that was needed to do the next step, in which what he really offered was frameworks of contemplation. So many of you will be familiar with the Satipatthana Sutta, you know, the teachings of how to establish mindfulness. This doesn't actually offer a technique, even though we live in meditative cultures where there's hundreds of insight meditation techniques. What the Buddha actually offered was a framework of contemplation. And what I've been offering here this weekend is another framework of contemplation. Now, what we do is we bring the meditative development through samatha into those frameworks of contemplation, primarily to investigate. And we bring the attitude of metta, of befriending, into that investigation. So it's a way of, you know, a kindly befriending-based investigation. Now these two areas are so dovetailed together, both the formal meditative development, which is really, if we really put it on its basic level, this is training the mind. It is training the mind, inclining the mind, developing the capacities of the mind for collectedness, for stillness, for quietude, for calmness, for peacefulness, for joy. We're actually training the mind in these capacities. This is absolutely, I would say, indispensable. I would say it is indispensable. And when we talk about developing samatha, please, I really want to not use the word concentration here. Samatha really describes our capacity to sustain attentiveness. And it describes a capacity for collectedness, a unification of body, mind, and present moment. And in that collectedness, being able to sustain attentiveness on any chosen object. Can be any chosen object. Now, as far as the Buddha was concerned, this was an absolutely indispensable skill, an absolutely indispensable training. This is actually what moves us in the direction of embodiment. It's what moves us and gives us the skills to investigate within these frameworks of contemplation. Okay? Gives us the skills to investigate in this way. So our investigation is not just a kind of another narrative, you know, or speculative thinking, or, you know, kind of rumination, that our investigation is actually quite experiential. Quite experiential. Now, a lot of the samatha training and collectedness is about stilling this tendency towards proliferation. You know? In fact, one of the synonyms of nibbana is apapancha. Apapancha. No longer proliferating, no longer spreading out, you know. Because actually what we see, probably in our own experience, the degree to which we just get blinded by the narrative. We just get blinded by the story, you know. And it seems like to have a life of its own, you know. This constantly generating, of this proliferating of thinking. And actually the proliferation of thinking is always rooted in some of these very tendencies that we're concerned with actually relinquishing. That obscure freedom, that are binding. So very much samatha practice is about learning to bring papancha. You know, you're all familiar with the word papancha? Everybody? Anybody not familiar with the word? Okay, this is why I use the word papancha, okay, because the definition is really long. It's the generation of thinking rooted in underlying tendencies and beliefs that clouds and distorts our capacity to see things the way they actually are. Got it? The generation of thinking rooted in underlying beliefs and tendencies that clouds and distorts our capacities to see things the way they actually are. So these are our thought storms. These are the narratives we get lost in. You know, and there's craving-based papancha. You know, all the stories that we have about what we want and need to become and need to get, you know, and all the strategies and the rehearsals around that. There's aversion-based papancha. Well, we probably know that one. You know, all the reasons why I dislike what I dislike, you know, and, you know, why it's so unlikable and, you know, what I need to do to get rid of it and blah, 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 blah. You know, there's fear-based papancha, you know, all the anxiety stories, you know, about the future and the planning and the strategizing and, you know, how we need to protect ourselves. There's ditty-based papancha, which is view-based papancha. Just turn on your television any moment at this time and you will get a real taste of ditty-based papancha. It's a big one, you know, but we have views about everything, don't we? We have opinions about everything, you know, and, you know, it's kind of like we love to share them. We're very generous with them. And then there's mana-based papancha, which is the self story. The self story, the narrative that we have about ourselves, you know, about who we are and where we are, etc., etc. So the Buddha really recognized, you know, this tendency to proliferate as being very woven into the whole dynamic of fabrication. That fabrication can't actually happen. without papancha. You know? Fabrication feeds on papancha. Huh? So papancha is really woven into this tendency to construct personality view, to construct worlds, you know, to construct worlds based on aversion and craving and doubt and attachment. So papancha is so woven into this. So in terms of the kind of Buddhist approach is, if you can calm the camouflage, you might actually see what's going on. You know, if you can calm the camouflage, you might actually be able to see what's actually driving these fabrications and driving and generating dukkha. Okay? So samatha is a highly developed skill, quite frankly. There's no shortcuts. Sorry? There are no shortcuts. It requires time, requires commitment, requires perseverance, requires patience, requires the willingness to begin again, requires clear intention about what we're doing when we sit down on a cushion or go on into our walking path, to actually know what that time is in the service of and what it's dedicated to. You know, I have grave doubts about just sitting and watching. Grave doubts about this. You know, we're actually developing a skill here and a capacity, and that requires, like any other skill or art in our life, it requires dedication and it requires commitment. Now, samatha is not only a cushion practice. Samatha has a lot to do with what I spoke about this morning in terms of wise attention off the cushion. You know, this is actually a training not only in sitting practice, it's a training for our lives. To really, really be sensitive to those moments actually when proliferation is happening and really seeking out those moments of apapancha, you know, of calming the narrative. Not much is helped in this life by papancha. You might have noticed that. Doesn't help effective action, doesn't help effective response, you know, doesn't help skillful means, you know. In fact, it pretty much clouds all of that. You know, and so to learn how to bring that to some stillness, to learn how to bring that to some calmness, which of course is where the body is such an ally. You know, in one of the discourses here where the Buddha is talking about the path to liberation, he says mindfulness of the body. Mindfulness of the body is the doorway to liberation. It's stepping out of all of that proliferation and bringing the mind to some stillness. Now, referring to that sutta I was talking about earlier, if nothing is found here to welcome, to delight in, or cling to, this will fade away. I mean, we can be quite attached to papancha. It's unhelpful. So samatha, this is absolutely critical to bring the mind to some stillness so we can see what's going on, so we can incline the mind towards investigation, towards understanding, and towards awakening. Quite frankly, lost in papancha, we have inclined the mind towards confusion. You know, we have inclined the mind towards entanglement in papancha. You know, so this is a really huge piece of the Buddha's teaching on inner development, is to develop this skill. And this is not talking about no thought here. It's talking about not being entangled in proliferation. It's not making an enemy out of thinking. But it's really, really actually seeing the dangers of being entangled in proliferation. So that requires, you know, it actually requires practice, it requires training. The other meditative development that the Buddha mentions quite specifically is the development of metta, which is also indispensable. You know, this requires an attitude of kindness, it requires an attitude of care, of tenderness, of affection, of friendliness. You know, again, countering that tendency to of harshness, of being so critical, being so judgmental, being so aversive. quite frankly, the biggest shift I ever see anybody make, either in contemporary mindfulness or in classical meditative development, is a shift from aversion to metta. I cannot think of a single more radical shift. If that is possible for us, we're a long way along the path. We're really a long way along the path. So the Buddha very much weaves these two together, and then he brings us into these frameworks of contemplation. Now, those frameworks of contemplation are many. It might be the three characteristics, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, non-self. The framework of contemplation may be the four ways of establishing mindfulness. The framework of contemplation may be actually what we've been talking about this weekend. What is being relinquished and what is being cultivated in the steps towards awakening? In the steps towards awakening. Now, this framework of contemplation, again, is not just thinking about it. It's actually bringing this into the field of intentionality. Bringing this into the field of intentionality. Like I suggested here over this weekend, of going into a walking period, taking with you a background intention of actually seeing, where is personality view being formed? Where is the attachment to habit really manifesting? Where is there an argument with impermanence? To actually bring these frameworks of contemplation into quite an intentional framework of investigation. Now, this framework of investigation is often happening just in present moment experience. It's not like we're adding something extra to it. But we are bringing this intention to investigate. The intention to investigate. Now, this is something that, can happen on a cushion, can happen in life, can take place anywhere. As I've said a number of times, we have already the raw material for those investigations. We don't need to add anything, we don't need to look for anything. It is actually all right here. But what you see here is the role of intention, don't you? The role of intention. And, it is said that the whole of this path rests upon the head of the pin of intention. So intention is actually inclining the mind towards investigating, towards seeing more clearly, towards relinquishing the origins of distress. So this is very much an intention-led practice. And, I wouldn't underestimate this. I think sometimes we get so, we can get confused by the spectrum of techniques available. We can start reifying one technique over another technique. We can start saying, oh, should I do this? Should I do that? And techniques can be really, really skillful allies and really, really skillful friends. But of course, we also have to be aware of where we start clinging even to a technique like the raft. We're actually getting to the other shore and we're still hauling this thing around, and now it's my practice and my technique and my tradition and my style. This is not what the Buddha was pointing towards, but having an intention-led practice in whatever format that falls, but to emphasize this element of samatha, these elements of samatha, of metta and investigation, experiential investigation, in whatever framework we're using. And sometimes it's really helpful, to take a framework for a period of time, like we've been talking about this weekend. There's plenty of material there for investigation. So where do I turn that actually into an insight that I'm practicing? When I see the arising of personality view, what does it mean to practice that insight in that moment? Does it mean looking at what's feeding that, what's sustaining that, what's shaping that? Does it mean having that curiosity? If I see the sort of manifestation of doubt and I'm starting to waver and wobble, you know, what does the practice of commitment as an insight actually mean in that moment? It means I'm learning to walk through the arising, the doubt surge, rather than feeding it, I'm feeding confidence. You know? So when I see the arising or the appearance of you know, habit and attachment to habit, you know, what does it mean to practice the insight of actually relinquishing that habit in that moment? Maybe I'm doing something differently. Maybe I'm making a commitment to mindfulness rather than habit, you know? Maybe I'm cultivating the opposite of what I'm doing. But actually to learn to actually bring that experiential investigation, that practice of insight, I think into our path is absolutely crucial. Sitting down with fingers crossed is not the way to nibbana. And I think it's, you know, it's kind of hoping for the best, but, you know, it's actually not, I don't find much support for that, I must say, in the early discourses. It's definitely outlined in the discourses, this is a path, it has a beginning, and it has a culmination, and it has a fruition. You know, and in order to kind of stay close to that path, we need the allies, we need the conditions that really incline the mind towards awakening. Okay? Do you have any questions around this or thoughts around this? Yeah.
Just a clarification. I think sometimes I interchange wise attention and mindfulness particularly.
Okay, what is the difference between wise attention and mindfulness? I would say that wise attention is the first of the four limbs of mindfulness. You know, it's a very necessary part. It's developing that simple knowing. It's stepping out of the narrative. The other three limbs of mindfulness is protective mindfulness. Learning to protect the mind from surges of impulse and habit. You know, the simile that's often used is a gatekeeper at the gates of a city. It's bringing in discernment about who it's helpful to welcome into the city and who it's helpful to refuse entry, you know? So this is where the element of discernment is coming into mindfulness, and that is absolutely a critical piece of mindfulness because that's where mindfulness starts to engage with wise effort. Because discernment is really about what leads to distress. What leads to distress and away from freedom, and what leads to the end of distress and towards freedom. The third limb of mindfulness is investigative awareness. You know, and again, the simile that's used there is the surgeon's probe of, you know, really knowing the nature of the wound, knowing its origins, making a prognosis, you know, and prescribing a course of treatment. And the fourth dimension of mindfulness is about reframing cognition or reframing perception. Now, the obvious way that this happens, or that perhaps the most obvious way that's presented in the discourses on this, is through metta. You know, that which I regard as an enemy in the light of metta ceases to be an enemy. But actually this is happening all the time through mindfulness because it is actually what is stripping perception of its associations. Okay? So that's our capacity to see something anew rather than to see through the eyes of our conclusions or, you know, what we've seen before or our assumptions or our beliefs. So it's our capacity to reframe perception. Another way of reframing perception is actually in the light of the three characteristics of impermanence, of unsatisfactoriness, and of non-self. Okay. So those are the four dimensions of mindfulness. The wise attention, the skillful attention, is absolutely the critical starting point because that's also where we are moving towards apapancha. Huh? We're moving towards that simple knowing rather than our story about what's going on. So it's an absolute critical starting point for all of the other limbs of mindfulness.
Confusion in that the contemplative
place of concentration, you know, going into intention as opposed to, analytical type, listing and
reflecting. Well, there's nothing at all amiss with reflective thinking, and investigation really has those two levels of experiential investigation and reflective investigation. The reflective investigation is absolutely critical. You know, we absolutely do need to have an intellectual agreement with what we're hearing, or else we have no more steps to take with it, you know. So that's absolutely essential. So that reflective thinking is important, and sometimes that's a dedicated space, you know. That can be a very dedicated time, just as we might have a dedicated time for really sustaining attention. We can have a very dedicated time to reflective thinking. Now, what we need to guard against is that reflective thinking turning into papancha and proliferation. Now, the clues for that is obvious. It's repetition. You know, when we're starting to repeat, that's not reflective thinking anymore, that's obsession.
So are you saying there's a difference between the reflective meditation versus contemplative?
Rather than the experiential investigation. The experiential investigation would probably be very much intention led. For example, I'm going to sit and I'm going to actually contemplate impermanence experientially. I'm going to actually see the beginnings and the endings, the arisings and passings of sensations, sounds, thoughts. I'm actually just going to focus on those beginnings and endings. It's experiential investigation. It's experiential investigation. I'm going to sit and I'm actually going to notice or have just as an intention within this field of experience. The shifts from clinging to non-clinging. I'm going to notice that experientially. So it's just kind of setting that background intention, and here we have our world of experience at the moment, which is all that's needed. Just all that's needed. So it's actually just noticing these different dimensions of meditative development. The samatha is important. I would not use, personally, I don't use the word concentration. The samatha is important, you know, the reflection is important, the frameworks of contemplation are important. And for the samatha to be transferred over to these frameworks of contemplation, first we need to have the information, you know, and then we have the intention. Yes? It's not the translation of samatha, you know. I mean, concentration is it can be useful, and in many ways it can be quite a skillful practice. But you know, it does involve exclusion, and it is always I tend not to use it. First of all, people have many associations with it, you know, from school, just concentrate, you know. But this gatheredness, this capacity to sustain attention, that's not necessarily exclusive. You know, it's not actually saying I'm going to exclude everything else. Now, a concentration practice would do that, and there is value to many of those concentration practices. But we have to recognize that anything that is state-related, you know, concentration state-related, is actually going to be pretty ephemeral. But learning to sustain attentiveness is a big one. For more than one moment, you know. For more than one moment is okay. So I want to go on for a little bit. So we talked this morning primarily about the insights of stream entry. And remember, we're talking about what falls away. So we're actually talking about what has fallen away not to re-arise. So belief and personality view, it's doubt, it's the attachment to rites and rituals as a means of providing security and certainty and safety. Okay? This, as I've said a number of times, is actually the first, most significant, most important turning point in our process of awakening. Because it's taken away that ground, or it's taken away a lot of the ground of clinging, which is personality view. So it's taken away a lot of the ground of that clinging. In actually surrendering that, the attachment to rites and rituals, we're coming a little bit closer, aren't we, to finding some ease and some confidence within a changing, uncertain, unpredictable world of conditions. So in a sense, this is a kind of embracing of a sort of the way things are, isn't it? We're not trying to pin things down anymore, to make them stand still. We're actually opening to and finding the courage and the confidence to embrace this changing, uncertain, unpredictable world in a fearless way. We're not needing to pin ourselves down through personality view. We're not needing to pin you down through creating a self in you. So we're actually beginning to actually move towards being a participant within this dynamic unfolding moment without having to make it something for me, without having to protect and to defend. So if you remember yesterday, I was talking about our arguments with the unarguables. You know? So here we're starting to put down the argument. We're actually starting to embrace dukkha. We're starting to embrace change and uncertainty. So actually we're actually relinquishing that third layer of dukkha, which is our reactivity and our argument with how things actually are. So there's a movement towards this alignment of putting down the argument. This is a huge step towards freedom. It's a huge step towards peace, which is why stream entry and the understandings of stream entry are actually said to be the most significant ones in this whole template of awakening. Now again, just repeating what I said, there is path and there is fruition. So practice with these insights, you know? Practice with these insights. Practice with the, you know, confidence in the midst of doubt. Practice with seeing the emptiness of personality view in the moments when it's starting to become rigid. Practice with the insights of those times when we find ourselves just being governed by habit, whether it's behavioral, emotional, or psychological. Practice with what it is actually to cultivate what is not habitual, what it is to step out of those habitual pathways. So actually really seeing that it's actually the practicing of these insights that leads to their fruition, okay, and their falling away. And this is a movement towards the freedom that is found in living in the light of what we know and living aligned with the way things actually are. This is where there is peace. This is where there is the cessation of fear. Okay, so one really has to frame it sort of in the context also of the bigger teaching. Now the way that this map is laid out is in kind of four stages of awakening, of stream entry, and then these very strange terms of once returner and non-returner, and then Arahant, which is the fully awakened. Now, most of the scholars that I know of the early texts really don't make much distinction between these two middle stages, really. There's not much difference in the early texts about them, so I don't think it's actually worth making them into two distinct things. But what is important to look at here is we talked about what is fading away, what is remaining. So actually, you know, if you think about this as a map of practice, you kind of start to think, okay, is there contractedness around anything? What do I contract around, you know? What's being contracted around inwardly? And the big ones here are actually craving and ill will, sensual craving and ill will. These are actually the big ones here. So this is, they're not, it's not said that they're hugely conditioning factors, but there's traces of them there. So the Buddha actually said, you know, okay, let's address these, let's actually look at these, let's practice with these, let's see where they're arising, let's see the conditions for their arising, let's see the conditions for their fading away. But again, we turn these into practices of insight and see, can the conditions for the arising of craving and aversion disappear? Okay, question for you. What are the conditions for the arising of craving?
Wanting things to be different.
Yeah, that's one of them, wanting things to be different.
Ignorance?
Yeah, ignorance for sure. There's always some level of ignorance at play here.
Greed
is the right, yes. I mean, greed and, yes, greed. Greed. Wanting things
to stay the same.
Yeah.
Fear.
How?
Fear of things not being the same.
Fear of things not being the same. Goodness me, it's a complex territory, isn't it? Yeah, wanting freedom from an unfortunate situation.
Freedom from an uncomfortable sensation.
And a lot of delusion, actually. You know, that actually the delusion that this is operative, you know, and that somehow, you know, it's actually the greed around sensual pleasure. So this is a lot of craving. This is about the craving for excitement, stimulation, aliveness, vitality, the wakefulness almost. But the delusion here, the delusion part, is that this is somehow, it's externally invested. It's externally invested, you know, so this is what I need to get in order to feel that comfort, that ease, that aliveness, that wakefulness. So actually the Buddha has, you know, this is quite a toxic power, actually. I mean, greed is quite a toxic power. And the Buddha, you know, the Buddha very much pointed to us, as long as we're kind of caught within any sankhara or pattern of greed, we're always in some way dissociated from the way things actually are. You know? We're always still, we're in a place of argument. You know? Aversion. What are the conditions for aversion to arise?
Grief.
Sorry?
Grief.
Grief?
Grief.
How? How is grief a condition for aversion to arise?
Wanting the situation.
Oh, greed. Greed. I'm sorry, I thought you said grief. Oh, you said grief. Wanting a situation to be different than it is.
And grieving because it will not be different.
Okay. Pain as a condition for aversion arising, probably quite similar.
Boredom.
Unpleasant Vedana. Unpleasant feeling tones in a lot of different ways. In a lot of different ways.
Personality view, when you see yourself and somebody else different, so you have a stronger feeling
about how other people should be different. Yeah, about how other people should be different than they are. I mean, what you see here, that, you know, what you see here in the threads of both greed and aversion, you know, or craving aversion, you know, is basically what we do with pleasant and unpleasant feelings. What we do with pleasant and unpleasant feelings. That's the kind of the core of it, isn't it? And, you know, those unpleasant feelings can be physical, they can be psychological, they can be emotional, but they are what we do with pleasant and unpleasant feelings. Okay? I mean, what is absent in those moments of meeting pleasant and unpleasant feelings that allows for or encourages the arising of greed or aversion? What is absent? equilibrium, equanimity, resilience. A lot of things are absent, aren't they? A lot of things make the mind sort of inclined towards being so governed by greed and by aversion. I mean, it's quite useful to lay out the landscape, isn't it? Because again, it's where are you going to orient yourself in this? Are you going to orient yourself on the reactivity, or are you going to orient yourself on what's missing and what can be cultivated? I think, you know, when we talk about this kind of stage of awakening, we're actually talking about getting out of a cycle, aren't we? We're talking about getting out of these patterns, these cyclical patterns of repetition, you know, where we keep finding ourselves in the same reactive pattern, in the same reactive cycle in relationship to the pleasant and the unpleasant. It's no surprise in the Buddha's teachings that he really pointed to this pleasant, unpleasant nature of experience as being the very weakest link in the whole fabricating process. You know, that if we can actually be present in that pleasant, unpleasant feeling tone of experience, if we can be really mindful there, we're actually taking away the fuel for fabrication. We're taking away the fuel for world construction. It's not very easy to be mindful there, is it? Because, I mean, the process happens so quickly, doesn't it? From actually just an unpleasant feeling to the flinch and the flight and the papancha. You know, and the pleasant feeling happens so quickly, that movement towards and the seizing hold of, and again the papancha, you know, and the fabricating. But this is such a crucial, you know, such a crucial piece. And, you know, and once more, you know, how far do we have to look for the raw material of awakening? You know, not outside of this moment right now. Can we just erase the word phrase "worked on"? Yeah, we are actually talking about. What we're actually talking about here, you know, if we put this in a very traditional language, we talk about the sort of chains that are unbound.
So these are people who are already stream enters.
They're already stream enters. Yep, Lisa. Gone.
The things that we talked about that would be contributing to greed and aversion
should be gone too, not necessarily. Because we haven't dealt with the big one yet. Well, we haven't dealt with the, well, we have dealt with it. We have talked about it, which is mana. Which is mana lurking on the horizon, you know, exerting these subtle influences, you know, about how to